Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is, once again, I'm still here, your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 29th of July, 2013, at 11 in the evening. This is Nav Briefing number 78, and the title is The Aretic Proposition. Now, I'm recording this briefing this evening from the upper terrace of my little Turton's Palace in Andalusia. Sitting beside me on the divan is my precious little black cat, or what appears to be my cat, Nikita. And arching over me is the perfectly black and cloudless sky of a summer night in Spain. It's been quite a day, and to begin this briefing, I'd like to tell you something about my day as a continuation of the little reportage that I have been using in the briefings lately. You know, I've been talking about the weather, the sky, and what I see in the sky. So, yesterday, I guess, whatever yesterday means, I saw something in the sky which I might call the augury of the two vultures. This word augury, I don't know. I mean, A-U-G-U-R-Y. I think augury means the art of divination by omens. I don't know if an individual omen is called an augury or not, and I'm too lazy to go look it up. Also, I don't like to use the internet because it's too slow for me. But an augur, I believe, A-U-G-U-R, an augur is someone who performs divinations. Anyway, I'm going to stick to this word, augury. I saw an augury, the doubling of a vulture, which I described in the last briefing. That was yesterday, right? Whatever yesterday means, right? Well, today, July 29th, it happened again, almost at exactly the same time. So this is how it played out, my friends. I was up late on Sunday night and into Monday morning. Monday is the day just ending now by the conventional calendric format. And so I slept until about 2:30 in the afternoon. And when the Turton emerged from his crypt there down below and came out, made a cup of coffee, came out into the light of day, came up to the upper terrace where I'm sitting now in the cool and balmy air of the evening, and looked around, and what did the Turton see? Well, he saw the inverted bowl of the sky, quite a lovely deep turquoise, totally cloudless, crystal clear, and without airplanes. So I sat here drinking my coffee at 2:30, and I couldn't help wondering, what is going on? I can't remember when I came back from Belgium, but I've been back. Well, yes, I can. I came back on the 12th, so I've been back 17 days. Okay, at least 8 of these days, or not, if not 10, there has been an impeccably clear and cloudless sky with no airplanes. how subjective is this experiment? I don't really know. I'm in the process of investigating that question, honestly. So I sat here. I got up here at around 2:30 with my coffee, and I thought, well, I won't use a vulgar expression from the old Santa Fe days. I'll just say, well, holy moly, mamacita, how long can this go on? I think I'll just sit here for 3 hours and see if anything happens, which is exactly what I did. No planes. Okay, so I said, I've got to go up to the local village. I'll go up at 6 o'clock, and I'll kind of hang around and linger. I'll wander around the village for an hour after I do my groceries, shopping, and I'll see if there are any planes from there. I go up there, no planes, no airplanes. I come back down and sit here for another 2 hours, and there were no airplanes until 8:43 p.m. when I saw one tiny, perfect little dart of a jet with a short contrail flying toward Casablanca. Okay, so this is still happening. I am still witnessing this bizarre, planeless sky. It is, by objective standards, it is inconceivable and impossible that there should be no airplanes visible in this sky at the height of tourist season with international flyovers and many flights out of Madrid and Malaga and into Madrid and Malaga. Okay, inexplicable. I don't know what's going on. But that in itself is just part of what's happening. It happened again this afternoon, the doubling of the vulture. I was sitting here, 3:30, about an hour after I came up with my coffee, and I looked off to the right in the same direction that I looked off yesterday. Bingo, there's one vulture. It was the same size and looked very similar to the vulture that I saw yesterday. Okay, you got my attention. So to turn, I look at this vulture, and as soon as I look at it, it starts to spiral clockwise as seen from below. Sort of like it did the other day. It spirals and it rises, but it, instead of spiraling at an angle that brought it front and center over the top of my terrace, it spiraled rather more into the vertical, higher. Well, at a certain point, I had to stand up and step out on the terrace to see it because I built an awning over my terrace so that I can sit up here without frying my brains out in the Spanish summer heat. And I couldn't see it because it took a different trajectory. So I stand up, and then I look at the vulture, and now I'm looking up at about 65-degree angle into the vertical. It's spiraling, and it's still slightly off to my right. Then suddenly it breaks out of the spiral, and it starts to fly, not just glide. Remember, you can watch the vultures here glide with no movement of their wings for long periods of time. Then sometimes they flap their wings. So it's flapping its wings and flying off to the northwest. I thought, I better pay attention. It looks like the same vulture. It's doing a slightly different act, but I'm really going to watch it. So I stood up out on the terrace in front of the awning, and I watched it slowly turning my head from left to right. And at the moment when I turned my head, just about a quarter of a turn, something caught my attention out of the corner of my eye to the left. And I immediately shifted my gaze, and there in the left of my field of vision, at the same level of the vulture I had been viewing, was a second vulture. Now I can guarantee you that when I stepped out on the patio to look at this bird, this magnificent bird, and to follow its flight, I took a moment to look at the entire sky. The entire sky was empty. There was one vulture in the sky. There were no vultures on the ridge off to my left. Sometimes they float down along the ridge, and that way they ease themselves down into the valley while they're looking for carrion. No vultures on the ridge. No vultures high in the sky. Sometimes they drop down out of thermals, and they appear to appear out of nothing. No vultures high in the sky. No vultures in the middle distance. Only one vulture in the sky. Until there were two. The vulture that I spotted out of the corner of my eye then falls into formation behind this first vulture, and they both proceed, flapping their wings casually and easily, slow and easy, just the way I like it. They both proceed to fly in the same direction, toward the northwest. This time, however, the second vulture, the double of the first, identical in size, is quite a distance behind the first one. So the second vulture did not appear by an act of doubling that resembles the double vision you have when you're drunk or when you get a blow on the head. It just came out of nowhere. And I watched the two of them fly off to the northwest. How subjective is this experiment? You and I are in the process of finding out. And what I can say right now, sitting out here on the terrace under the stars with a scorpion right in front of me with Antares glittering, what I can say right now is that if you want to know how this experiment works, then you want to tune your mind and your imagination to the mysteries of the double and doubling. And that's exactly what I'm doing. And it looks as if I'm being given some fine opportunities to peer into that mystery right now. To get up and running with this briefing, I'd like to give you a little bit of syntax to use for future reference, okay? But the challenge here is, and it really is a challenge, is to enter into and comprehend the interactivity of this experiment, right? Because only by doing so are you and I going to understand how she designed it. There's no theoretical or abstract way to understand how she designed it. You just have to enter into it. And in the interactivity, you learn how the interactivity works. But it might be helpful in my role as Nahual to provide a syntax for you to comprehend this interactivity. It's kind of like a tri-kaya paradigm. Tri-kaya, meaning three body, is a term in Sanskrit that is massively used in Tibetan Buddhism, along with a bunch of other terms that are used by people who don't have the faintest idea what they're talking about. But when I talk about Trikaya, I know exactly what I'm talking about. Now, the Gayan Trikaya is what you want to understand. The Gayan three-body system. Now, there are various ways to formulate this system and to put it into language. There's a cosmological way, there's a psychological way, and there's a phenomenological way. Right now, I'm presenting the phenomenological way to frame up the paradigm of Trikaya, or the three-body system. Put in the form of a question, my friends. Ask yourselves this. If I'm seeking to enter into, or let's say, no, if I'm seeking to engage and comprehend the interactivity of this experiment, how does that actually occur phenomenologically? Well, phenomenologically, it occurs in three ways. There are three kayas, or body shemas, to observe. Because kaya also means a shema, as well as body, okay? There are three interactive shemas to observe. If you want to find out how the experiment is interactive, you have to be precise. You have to ask yourself, how is it interactive in Shema 1, Shema 2, and Shema 3? The Trikaya paradigm. Okay? What are these three shemas? Well, quite simply, they are nature, culture, and rapport. Now, let me give you an example of my baffling and completely inexplicable interactivity with the experiment from this terrace, using this terminology. First of all, I've been back from Belgium for about 17 days. There are at least 8, probably 10 days when I have witnessed a completely clear sky with no cloud and no indication of any chemtrails or any kind of human interference in the atmosphere. That is, that observation falls into the schema of nature. I'm looking at the atmosphere. The atmosphere is a product of nature. She creates and maintains the atmosphere. So, I'm being interactive with nature, and in that interactivity, I observe a cloudless and impeccable sky. Now, what about airplanes? Well, airplanes do not belong to nature. Airplanes belong to the shema of culture, the second shema. So, I'm also interacting with culture as I sit on my terrace. I see the Bay of Algeciras. I see the lights of towns here and around the village. I see the lights of Jimena de la Frontera off to my right. That's culture. She didn't create those lights. Okay? I see no airplanes in the sky during the daytime. I don't see any now either, by the way. So I'm interacting with culture, but for some inexplicable reason, there's no evidence of culture insofar as airplanes are evidence of culture. Culture, by definition, is that part of the experiment that is added by human beings. Culture is the human-made part of the experiment, embedded in nature, which is the part of the experiment that she provides as the habitat for the primary subject, which is you and I, the anthropos. Okay. Finally, there is the kaya or shema of rapport. Now, what is rapport? Rapport is any interaction with any other human animal. Rapport does not include the interaction with non-human animals. Interaction with non-human animals belongs actually to the shema or kaya of nature, shema 1, shema 2 being culture, shema 3 being rapport. So, rapport is my interactivity with other human animals. My interactivity with my cat, Nikita, who is sitting here across from me on the couch, does not belong to shema 3, it belongs to shema 1. Get that picture. Well, what's a rapport? Well, I don't have any rapport. I mean, I haven't been talking to anybody but you about this extraordinary and inexplicable absence of airplanes, or the impeccable clarity of the sky, or the doubling of vultures. Only talking to you. You're my rapport right now. The only other rapport I have is a mad woman living in the neighborhood named Kundry. So I've been talking to Kundry about it. But otherwise, I was up in town today. Okay, I saw a couple of English-speaking people sitting at cafes and think I'm going to go up and talk to them about it. No, I haven't. What am I getting at here? I'm illustrating for you. I'm giving you content on my interactivity in the three shemas. Shema 1. Nature provided for us, the habitat, the setting. Shema 2, culture, the creation and product of humans themselves that is embedded in nature. And Shema 3, rapport, communication and interaction between human animals, which is embedded in culture. That's the picture. Make a note of that. Hold on to that three-fold paradigm. I have a feeling it's going to prove to be really useful in testing the question of interactivity. Now, I'm going to use an expression that I don't really understand. Well, I sort of do, but this is an expression that's current in the discourse or dianoia of the social networking medium of the world today. It involves the term ping. P-I-N-G. Have you ever heard the expression to ping the system? I'm not sure what this means. I'll tell you honestly, I mean brutally, frankly, for me, to ping the system is tongue on clit. That's how I would ping the system, you know? That's what pinging the system means to me. But apparently pinging the system means to send out a signal to see how people respond. And apparently the predators do this all the time. They're always pinging the system. You know, like, for instance, you know the famous story of the young girl, I think she was in Washington State, 10-year-old young girl who was arrested and fined for selling lemonade on her lawn. And they fined her like more than $100, you know. I understand now that this is the way that the feds, that is to say, a.k.a. the authorities, a.k.a. our quantified human beings, will, like, ping the social system. Why did they do that? Because they wanted to see how people respond to it. Because then they can know the degree of acceptance of control that they can exert upon the system. I'm just speculating here, folks. I don't really know what pinging the system means apart from tongue on nipple or tongue on clit. And that happens to be so, obviously, because I'm a depraved calico voluptuary, and that's all there is to it. You can take it or leave it. Regardless of that particular point, let's consider pinging the system in the three kaya paradigm to see how interactivity works. I can ping the system in the level of nature, in the zone of nature, ping the system in the zone of culture, and ping the system in the zone of rapport. I do that because I want to see if I'm being interactive. I want to see if I can actually affect the experiment in any or each of those three areas by my attention, by my intention. You get this idea. From here on out, I'm going to talk off and on about pinging the system to test for interactivity, okay? Hope I got this concept across, because regardless of my eccentric comments, it is extremely essential to the procedures of the GNE from this point onward. And I thank you for your tolerance. Now, listen. I have to tell you something that you're dying to know, and you don't even know you are. What you're dying to know is how to turn off the fucking mental radio. Now, why are you dying to know that? Because you can't ping the system unless you do that. No, correction. Let me say it better. If you want to ping the system at any of these three levels to find out if you can alter the experiment by interacting with it in nature, in culture, or in rapport, it helps enormously to turn off the mental radio first. You got me? You follow my drift. You see, the mental radio is always playing. Castaneda called it the interior monologue, I believe. And the mental radio interferes with interactivity with the divine experiment. This is a fact. And it's worse, gets worse, because you can't even read or register or detect or assess how you are interacting with the divine experiment of the Aeon Sophia in which you are embedded as long as the mental radio is playing. As long as the interior monologue is droning on and on and on in your mind. And so, the optimal technique, the shamanic skill required at this point, is turn off the mental radio to dispose your mind, aka attention, to the act of pinging and to the result of pinging. So, I'm proposing that at future moments in the remaining 10 months of this experiment, we ping the experiment. You ping it, and I do it in individual ways and individual moments to test for how the interactivity works. But in preparation for that crucial act of verification, need to know how to turn off the metal radio. And that's what I'm now going to tell you how to do. And the answer to how to do that is really simple. It comes in an old cliche. You know, people would say when they watch magicians, there's a stage magician and performs some incredible cliche of magic, like sawing a woman in half. And so you're sitting there in the audience and you're like, wow, jaw dropping. This guy just sawed this woman in half, you know. There she was, and then like he sawed the box and pulled the box apart, and her feet are waving over here, and her head and her hands are waving over here. And the person sitting beside you is a skeptic, of course, you know. And they, like, you're sitting there with your jaw open, and the person beside you nudges you with the elbow and says, it's done with mirrors. Well, that's how you turn off the mental radio. You do it with mirrors. Now I'm going to devote, I intend to devote, and it is my pleasure to devote the greater part of the remainder of this NAB briefing to matters of Gaian sorcery and supernatural magic. But they are extremely pertinent to the GNE. It's all coming together. It's all coming together in the GNE. It builds. And so it's my intention to describe how it's done with mirrors. Now, sorcerers work with mirrors. I work with mirrors. And I primarily work with three kinds of mirrors. The first kind of mirror is simply called the sorcerer's mirror. What is that? It's a non-inverting mirror. Now, when you stand in front of the mirror, typically in your bathroom, or if you have mirrors in other places in your house, when you stand in front of that mirror and look at yourself, and you raise your right hand and you put it against your face, exactly like I'm doing now. Put my right hand, fingers of my right hand, against my cheek. Pat my lovely cheek. What do you see in the mirror? You see your mirror image patting the left side of his or her face with his or her left hand. In other words, the ordinary mirror shows you an image of yourself, but right and left are inverted. You know, if you have someone film you, and then you film you, you know, touching the side of your face like I'm doing, touching the right side of my face with my right hand, you film that, and then you play it back on your computer, the image of you in the computer will be touching the right side of his or her face with the right hand. But in the mirror, no, it's inverted, because the mirror inverts right to left. The sorcerer's mirror is non-inverting. How do you make a sorcerer's mirror? You take two mirrors, two flat planes of mirrored glass, which you can buy in a hardware store. I have two in the other room over here. They're about, 10 inches wide by 14 inches high. They're simple panes of glass that are mirrored. You take them and you stick them together at a 90-degree angle with a piece of duct tape in the back. And then you set them down on the dresser. Now there's a seam in the image running down the middle of the image. That's true. But if you adjust those two plates of glass at a perfect right angle, held together in the back by a piece of duct tape, you'll see your non-inverted image in the mirror. This is called the non-ordinary mirror or sorcerer's mirror. This mirror can actually be used for exercises of bilocation. If you sit in a dark room in front of one of these mirrors, and you take a simple candle, like a votive candle that you can buy to place in a church or something, you place the votive candle at the place where the two mirrors converge. So it's inside the right angle of the two mirrors. And you sit there and you gaze at yourself. I assure you, you will bilocate. You may not understand how you're bilocating. You may not understand anything. You may not even realize you are. But that device will bilocate you. And if you do that practice repeatedly over a period of time, you will acquire the skills to navigate in the bilocation experience. Another effect of this non-ordinary, non-inverting mirror is that you will hallucinate on your own face. And you will see other faces lit by the candlelight in this non-inverting mirror, which is constructed of two mirrors at right angles to each other. That's the first of the three cases to which I'm referring, how it's done with mirrors. How does that stop the mental radio? Well, if you sit in front of that non-inverting mirror in candlelight in a room in which there is no other interfering light or artificial light source, you will be drawn into the second attention. And you will experience the suppression of inner talk. The internal monologue will drop away. And the effect of that dropping away is that you are released into your second attention, but you're not released into your second attention necessarily in a way that you can control or navigate consciously. You will sort of float into your second attention. And it's a fascinating exercise if you want to undertake it. But there are others that are much, much more powerful. The second way that it's done with mirrors to quell the internal monologue or turn off the mental radio so that you have access to silent knowing and you can ping the experiment is to use parallel mirrors. There are three ways that a Nawal positions mirrors. The first is at right angles, as I just explained. The second is parallel mirrors, and the third is facing mirrors. These are three exercises of escalating efficacy. I'll get to the third last. The third is the most effective in silencing the mental radio so that you can ping the experiment. But let me say a little bit about the second use of mirrors. Parallel mirrors operated like this. Go out to the DIY or the hardware store and buy these mirrors. Some people stick them on the wall. You know, you can buy 8 or 10 of them. You stick them on the wall because some people like to have mirrors on their wall. What they are just panes of mirrored glass. They're panes of glass. What makes the mirrors is that they have a silvering on the back of them, right? In the second exercise, you don't put the two mirrors together at right angles. You take the two panes, set them down on a table, you turn over one of those panes, and you carefully etch out some of the silver backing off the pane. Now, if you do that, you'll just have an ordinary pane of glass. I would propose that if you want to undertake this experiment, be extremely sober about what you're doing. Don't be frivolous. Frivolous. Well, that's a nice word. No, don't be frivolous, my friends. And above all, don't be frivolous. But be cautious and sober if you follow the instructions that I'm giving you right now. Remove from the backside of one of these mirrors some of the silver backing that makes it a mirror. I propose that you remove a small area of the silver backing in the form of a pentagram or pentagon with its point downward. So you do that, and then you turn the mirror over. Let's say this is the mirror on the table on the right hand. And lo and behold, it has a place in the center in the shape of an inverted pentagon that you can see right through like it's a pane of glass, which is all that it is. The other mirrored pane of glass, which is sitting face up on the left side of the table, you leave as it is. Now you take these two mirrored panes of glass. You stand them up vertically, one behind the other. The one in front has the see-through feature of the pentagonal shape, which you have produced by removing the mirroring. So you look at the first pane of glass, and you look through that little spy hole, as it were, to the second pane of glass. Now, there are rather, let me say what, I don't even know. I mean, I wouldn't even begin to speculate on what kinds of exercises in doubling you can do with that device. But right now, I'm not dwelling on that. So I'm going to the third instance of how it's done with mirrors. And that is the instance of facing mirrors. So suppose you have these two mirrors and you stand them up. You hold one in your left hand, one in your right hand, on a table in front of you. And you stand them up about a foot and a half apart, facing each other. That's the third exercise. Now, obviously, that leads to nothing because there is no image between the two mirrors. So the third exercise must be something different. It must be a different kind of mirroring. It doesn't use the two mirrors physically juxtaposed to each other, as in case A, a juxtaposition of right angles, and as in case B, a juxtaposition of one mirror placed about a foot and a half in front of the other, both positioned vertically. How can I describe to you the third exercise of how it's done with mirrors? Well, it's the exercise that I performed today as I was sitting on the terrace at the moment that I had the second incident of the doubling of vultures. Castaneda actually introduced this exercise sometime, in the early or mid-70s? Early 70s. Those of you who've read Castaneda through the years might recall that there were four books, of which the fourth was Tales of Power. And at the end of Tales of Power, Don Juan and Don Genero disappeared into the world of what? The green ants or the green beetles? I can't remember. They went off into some bizarre Nahual zone as if never to return. And those of us who were reading the Castaneda books at the time were like stymied and amazed to thinking, what the fuck? You know, where does it go from here? It was as if Castaneda was going to end the whole sequence of fables at that point, of shamanic fables. But in fact, then came along book number 5. It was called The Second Ring of Power. Now, book number 5 is a very troubling and problematical book in the sequence of Castaneda's books, because it represents a transition. And in some respects, it doesn't really work. But in others, it works beautifully well. But that book introduced women into the sorcerer's party, like La Gorda or La Soledad or La Catalina. Okay? And these women sorcerers began to figure very strongly in the fables of Neo-Toltec sorcery that Carlos Castaneda was developing during the 1970s. And somewhere, not exactly sure where it was, may have been in book 4, Tales of Power, or in book 5, Don Juan instructed Castaneda in a shamanic technique, which is called stopping the world. Now, stopping the world is synonymous with stopping the mental radio. Why am I talking about this? Because if you want to ping the experiment to find out how the interactivity actually works in the tri-kaya format of nature, culture, and rapport, the best way to do it is by turning off your mental radio. That is to say, that the results of pinging the experiment are optimally much higher if you can turn off the mental radio, which is what I was doing this afternoon. And now it's my pleasure to describe to you exactly how I did it. Now, I didn't get this technique from Carlos Castaneda, by the way. This is my own technique. I devised this technique. I have never publicly ever spoken of this technique. It is the technique of flexing the mirroring attention. What is the mirroring attention? It is the third attention. The first attention is logical and rational observation. The second attention is the dreaming attention with its particular subfunction of memory. The replay button of the dreaming attention is what we call memory. When you remember something, you're actually imagining it or reimagining it. Okay? First attention, second attention. And now we come to the third attention. And I'm beginning to think. I'm beginning to feel. I'm beginning to sense. That the great lesson of the third phase of this Gaian navigation experiment is about the mirroring attention, which is the third attention. Now, in the remaining 20 minutes of this briefing, I'm presenting to you a description of how to flex the third attention. To flex the third attention means to actually flex it as if it were a muscle. Like you would flex the muscle, the bicep muscle in your arm, by putting your arm into a right angle position and tightening the fist and rolling the fist a little. This afternoon, as I sat on the upper terrace of my house and witnessed the second event of the doubling of vultures, I was engaged in turning off the mental radio. And this is how you do it. It's an exercise in bilocation. To describe this exercise to you, going to use two simple reference, locational reference. The first location is my upper terrace. The second location is a terrace cafe in the village. So there's a village 10 minutes from my house by car where I sometimes go and have a glass of wine, eat some tapa. And I sit out on the terrace of that cafe. It has exactly the same view as the terrace of my house. It looks out to Gibraltar, to the Straits of Gibraltar, and across the Straits to the Rif and Atlas Mountains of Morocco. Difference is that my terrace is at about, 1,500 feet. And that terrace is at about 2,400 feet in the village, a higher level. There are two locations involved in this exercise of flexing the mirroring attention. That is to say, there are two literal locations in my description of this exercise. The first literal location is my terrace, and the second is the cafe terrace up in town. Now, these two locations are actually the two mirrors. You're not using the two mirrors literally, the two panes of mirrored glass from the two previous exercises. In this third exercise, no. In the third exercise, you use any two locations that you choose. Now, I'm describing the exercise relative to locations that I used and chose. When I was sitting here at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, at the time that I saw the second event of the doubling of vultures, I was using my location of my terrace and the location of the cafe terrace for an exercise in bilocation. And this is how it goes. I sat on my terrace where I am right now, on the couch, on the divan that folds out into a bed. Couch is positioned facing south. It's under an awning. So part of the terrace is in shade. But if I step out from under the awning, I can step out into full sunlight. This position on my terrace can be called the holding mirror. This is the holding mirror. The holding mirror is the place that holds my position, that holds an event. But it's just a mirror relative to another mirror. So this afternoon I sat here in the holding mirror. That is to say, I sat on the upper terrace of my house. But as I sat there, I pictured another mirror. This other mirror you can call the posing mirror or the composing mirror. So there are two mirrors involved in this exercise, but they are not like the physical mirrored panes of glass in the previous two. They are two mirrors that you visualize. The holding mirror and the posing or composing mirror. So, I sat on my terrace and I looked at myself, I looked at my body, I looked at the surroundings. I'm in the holding mirror. I sat there, leaning back against the couch with my left leg positioned up on the couch and my left hand on my knee. So you know how you can raise your leg, can raise your knee, in this case my left knee, and I can put my left arm out so that my wrist is on my knee and my hand just hangs over my knee. My right arm is extended across the back of the couch in which I'm sitting. Get this position. And my right leg is extended down upon the terrace. So this is the position that I assume in the holding mirror, just one of the mirrors of this exercise. So picture this. Picture me sitting on my terrace in this way. Now, as I sit on my terrace in this way, in the holding mirror, I picture myself in a second mirror, which is called the posing or composing mirror. What is the composing mirror? It is another location. It's actually another physical location. Specifically, it is the physical location on the cafe terrace in the village, 10 minutes from where I live. Here I am sitting on the terrace at 4 in the afternoon, but in 2 hours from that time, in linear time, I'm going to be sitting on the cafe terrace in the village. So while I'm here on my terrace, I picture myself on the cafe terrace. That is called the composing mirror. I compose a picture of myself in another location. But that's not all I do. I compose the picture of myself sitting in that cafe in the village. And I picture myself as I sit there, picturing me as I sit here now. In other words, here I am in the holding mirror, actually sitting on my terrace. But I picture myself sitting on the cafe terrace, picturing myself sitting on my terrace. In other words, I bring into connection in my imagination simultaneously two different moments and two different locations. It's later on in the afternoon from the moment that I'm sitting on my terrace that I'm going to be sitting on the cafe terrace up in town, right? So it's a later moment in linear time, if you want to put it that way. It's also a different location in space. But what connects those two moments in linear time and those two different locations in space is the picturing activity, which is the flexing of the mirroring attention. There are two mirrors facing each other in this exercise. One mirror is the holding mirror where I'm actually sitting on my terrace at a certain moment of the afternoon. The other mirror displays, that's the operative word, shows, displays, a different moment in the afternoon when I am sitting at a different location, namely the cafe terrace in town. These two moments, these two mirrors, the holding mirror and the composing mirror, face each other. To put them in the position of facing each other is what you do in this exercise. And it's a simple and easy thing to do. Sitting on my terrace at a certain moment in the afternoon, I pictured myself sitting on the cafe terrace in town. And in composing the picture of myself sitting on the cafe terrace in town, I imagined that from that position, I pictured myself sitting on my terrace at my house. And so, I composed an image of myself sitting at the cafe terrace in town. The operative word is composition, because this is the composing mirror. And the composing mirror is contrasted to the holding mirror. The holding mirror doesn't require picturing. The holding mirror simply requires perceiving. The holding mirror is where I actually sit at a certain moment on my terrace. All I have to do is look at my position, the way I'm sitting, which I just described to you, the way I position my legs and my hands, and everything that is around me that I can see from that position. But while I am maintaining that position in the holding mirror, I picture myself in another place, picturing myself in the holding mirror. The other place is called the composing mirror. So how do I picture myself in the composing mirror? Well, while I'm sitting here on my terrace in the afternoon, and this is during the moment that the doubling of the vultures appeared, that the doubling of the vultures occurred, I should say. While I'm sitting there, I picture myself already up on the cafe terrace. I sit at the terrace at a table in a particular way. I have my left knee turned so that my left ankle is sitting on my right knee. I'm pulled away a little from the table. I have ordered fizzy water with a glass of ice and a glass of white wine and some tapa. I picture the bottle of fizzy water sitting on a napkin. And directly to the left of the bottle of fizzy water, I picture the glass with ice in it in which I pour the fizzy water. Then I picture the two tapas that I've ordered. And to the left of that, I picture the glass of vino blanco, buenos, a white wine like a Cabernet Sauvignon. I picture exactly how I am sitting on the cafe terrace before I actually go up to town to sit there. But I don't just do that. I don't just picture the particulars of the situation of sitting on the cafe terrace. I do that. You do that. You compose the mirror in that way. But it's after you have composed the mirror with those elements, then you picture yourself, as I did, in the composing mirror, picturing myself in the holding mirror. So, before I went up to the cafe terrace in the village, I pictured myself on the cafe terrace, picturing myself as I actually was sitting on my own terrace in the holding mirror. This is the way to flex the mirroring attention. The exercise of flexing the mirroring attention is extremely powerful. I have never verbally disclosed this technique before. I give it to you now, and I need to elaborate it more, I know, more clearly, more simply, more simplifically, so that you can understand how this exercise stops the world, and it stops and arrests the mental radio and the internal monologue. And what is the objective of stopping the internal radio? Just as I said at the beginning of this briefing, because the mental silence of that radio, of turning it off, provides the optimum opportunity to ping the experiment to see if you're interactive with it. I know that all of you are craving, who really listen to me, I say all of you who really listen to me, all of you who are really on board this experiment, must be salivating to know how to test the interactivity and thereby to enter actively, passionately, perceptually, morally, and in every conceivable manner into her designs and purposes that originally established the conditions of your life and of any life that is possible for a human animal on this planet. I know that you, like myself, have an intense longing to test this experiment. And this is how you can do it. So I need to elaborate in the following briefing more carefully, more closely, and more precisely in how to do this. And it is my intention to continue in that fashion. For right now, to conclude this briefing, let me refer to the title of this briefing, which is The Eretic Proposition. Everything that I say now, everything that I say in the remainder of time in this stall, which lasts until about the 15th of August, is directed toward one single and particular objective. And that objective is to register in your mind what is the eretic proposition. Now, the word eretic, A-R-R-E-T-I-C, comes from a Greek word, ereton. I don't know where I encountered this word originally. Maybe in Eliade, maybe in Joseph Campbell. The ereton is the event or experience which stops you in your tracks. It arrests you. Ereton. It is the arresting event. For instance, if you were driving along, going shopping somewhere to a local village, a local town, and you came around a curve and there was a magnificent train crash in front of you, like the one that happened recently in the north of Spain. Wow! You slam on the brakes, you sit there, and in that moment you are completely arrested by what is in front of you. You are arrested at the moment that you see a burst of lightning in the sky. That is an erratic moment. Erratic means having the capacity to stop you in your tracks, to arrest you, and to seize your total attention in the moment. The purpose of these exercises, and particularly the third mirroring exercise, is to bring you to the eretic proposition. The eretic proposition is the proposition by which every single human animal enters into the knowledge of the syntax of her dreaming. You enter into the active and interactive knowledge. You don't just know it theoretically. You don't just dream about it in the abstract. You don't just wonder about it. It is applied wonderment. You enter directly into activity through the eretic proposition. The exercise I described can bring you to the eretic proposition. I can state the eretic proposition, and I'm going to state it in concluding this briefing. I can easily state it, I can easily put it in language, but for me or anyone to put the eretic proposition in language is not enough. It's only halfway there. You have to be in the position where you can be seized by the eretic proposition. As you would be seized in the mouth of a lion or a grizzly bear, and it would toss you into the Nahual of the Wisdom Goddess. So what is the eretic proposition? The Aeon Sophia designed the experiment that you are in and of which you are the primary subject in such a way that you can come to know how that experiment works. But not merely know how the experiment works on this planet, merely for the pleasure of knowing, merely for the thrill of knowing, merely for the sublime privilege of knowing. Not merely that, but to know how this experiment works according to its original design so that you can assist the divine intelligence that designed the experiment in its correction. That is the eretic proposition. All of your life, all of the questions you've asked, all of the things you've wondered about, everything you've wanted to know about nature, everything you've wanted to know about the design of the cosmos, down into the granular detail of human events, of human destiny, everything that you have longed and desired to understand about the purpose of being alive terminates in the eretic proposition. And everything begins
from that proposition. It is the end, or telos, of all human seeking.
And it is the beginning of what lies beyond all that seeking. After all, where did you think it was going to take you to seek and to question and to investigate? What would happen to you when you arrived at the objective of that seeking? I don't know a better way to answer that rhetorical question than read the lines from Thunder Perfect Mind that I use to conclude my book, Not in His Image. I am the incomprehensible silence and the often remembered thought. I am the voice of many sounds and the expression of many designs. I am the utterance of my own name. I am the Sophia of the Greeks and the Gnosis of the barbarians. The one who has been hated everywhere and loved everywhere. I am godless, and I am she whose godhood is multiple. I am the one whom you have considered and whom you have scorned. I am unlearned, and it is from me that you learn. I am the gnosis of my seeking and the finding of those who seek after me.